You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. Good evening, I'm Al Voner, and this is this week's edition of The Public Eye. Nice to have you with us. Once again, I'm wearing my historian hat and cape this weekend. A fascinating book just came across my desk a few weeks ago. As you know, I love biographies, and I think it's so important, especially young people, but any age, actually. But history, the rich history and culture of this country can only be understood by reading about what took place before many of us came. And like ourselves, we'll always wonder if the next generation is studying what we've done. But I've asked my guest this week, Charlie C.W. Goodyear. His new book is President Garfield, The Radical to Unifier. And we're talking about President James Garfield, the 20th President of the United States, a man who does not get much notice, a man whose name you may not find in too many history books. But I was intrigued by the man's his passion for leadership, his passion to work alongside colleagues for the betterment of this country. And that's what I think is so very important in the book. So we'll be talking with C.W. for the next half hour about his new book, President Garfield, and getting his motivations and the passion that he felt in writing the book. C.W., nice to have you with us.
Thanks, Al. It's entirely my pleasure. And I should just say that I really appreciate you putting on your historian's hat again for me here today.
Yeah, thank God it's not quite the perfect fit, but it doesn't fall over the eyebrows, at least not yet. Anyway, Garfield.
Yeah, it's all right.
When I was growing up, when I was going to school 100 years ago, it was Lincoln, and I love reading about Abraham Lincoln, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and then you move forward, and you've got the Eisenhowers, you got the Roosevelts, the Kennedys. To this day, those seem to be the names that are pretty much synonymous when people, even if they're not historians, even if they're not politically inclined, that you tend to hear. James Garfield is not a name that you get a lot of people to talk about. Many people go, who's that? Is that your neighbor? Is that an uncle? So why is that? Let me ask you first and foremost, why doesn't a guy like James Garfield get the same recognition that other presidents have?
Well, let's see. I should start by saying it's probably for what would on the surface seem to be a very good reason. The way American society remembers its leaders, the way we remember our presidents, is based pretty much purely off of what they did in the White House and their continued policy relevance today. And by that metric, you're right. There are about 10 names that for, you know, the better part of, I'd say 50 years, that we're constantly going back to. If you stop the average American on the street and you ask them to name presidents, you know, you would think that we've only had 10 occupants of the White House since 1776. And that is a fine metric to try to remember our leaders by. But the deeper story, and I think that the way in which that view of our history falls a little bit short, is that there are broader narratives behind these men and the lives they led, and they have all been men so far. Garfield is a very good example of somebody who was who led an incredible, exemplary American life, who was described, even before he was elected to the presidency in 1880, as the most accomplished American of all time, who then entered the White House. He ostensibly against his will, he made a very big show of not wanting to be president, and he had good reasons for doing so that we might get into later. And then he was assassinated within his first year of office. And so again, to go back to that traditional metric of how do we judge presidents, he falls short, and not by his own choice. He would have preferred to be at the very pinnacle of American power for longer.
Yeah, and the things that stood out for me, and I didn't even realize this, and you adequately describe this in the book, is not only did he have the political aspirations. Well, first and foremost, let me back up a little bit. This is a guy that came from a log cabin, like the Lincoln story. Certainly, came from poverty. basically was an early day bootstrapper, if you will. Didn't necessarily have a direction at first, but through hard work, through determination, through wanting to achieve personal goals, as you said, he achieved so many things. He was a magnificent educator. He certainly, his military service, politics was not first and foremost in his mind, but I think he always had the desire to do what he could for the betterment of mankind. Does that sort of sum him up?
I think it does, yes. And it's easy to list, you know, you mentioned his bootstrapping nature. I can just list his achievements. He was the last president to be born in a log cabin. He was raised by a single mother, his family being of Massachusetts origins, actually. So that makes this appearance on your show of a special relevance to me. He was then a college president, a state senator, and a very famous preacher in rural Ohio by his late 20s. He was the youngest general in the Union Army during the Civil War. He was then, halfway through the Civil War, the youngest congressman in the country. And then for the next basically two decades, he served in Congress, and he, as part of that, founded the first federal Department of Education. He practiced law in front of the Supreme Court while also serving in Congress. And he also wrote an original proof of the Pythagorean theorem in his free time. So there is no more compelling, resume that I could find among American statesmen. But yeah, no, his motivations were incredibly noble. He had a very poetic view of American destiny and of the potential of our republic. He had progressive ideals about the future of America. He believed that one day that we would be a truly free and civil rights-based republic. He believed that we would one day have clean government. He had this very optimistic future for America, and he very much wanted to be a part of that change from an early age. That's actually what motivated him to fight in the Civil War in the first place. He wanted to be part of this liberating Northern army going to the South to liberate slaves personally. And so his motivations were pure from that aspect. He also, though, very importantly, he saw the potential for personal gain in all of that stuff. He was, despite, you know, his noble intentions for going into public service, he was also volcanically ambitious, is how I put it. I have a piece of his writing here from when he was only a teenager, and he had just finished an oration before this school that he was attending. So he had just been given this honor of addressing the class, and he was terribly nervous about it. But upon giving this speech and doing really a knockout job, he wrote the following. The ice is broken. I am no longer a cringing scapegoat, but am resolved to make a mark in the world. I know without egotism that there is some of the slumbering thunder in my soul. So, and again, this is somebody who came from a hard scrabble background, who was in poverty in rural Ohio. But as soon as he was given a chance to prove himself and to sharpen his mind being this great weapon of his, he seized that with all his might. And he saw in that not just the chance for self-fulfillment, but for being part of what he thought to be a necessary and positive change for
right.
the public.
I get the what I got from by the time I finished the book. I'm thinking back as you were talking about didn't come from wealth, didn't come from highly educated folks. Really hard scrabble, and I couldn't agree with you more that if you have to sum up the book, what motivated this man, what made this guy stand out, it was that he recognized early on that, if nothing else, he didn't have great wealth, he didn't have great influence, not at the early days, but he had an intellect. And he thought, this is my gift, this is my tool. If I use this in the proper way, it'll help propel me to achieve the things that most people would just think were unattainable. So I really found a respect for him. And I assume that, you know, and I meant to ask you that at the outset, were these some of the things that drew you to wanting to write about him?
Yeah, it certainly made it very easy. When you see the depth of the learning this man accomplished, he was described by another president, Rutherford Hayes. There is a phrase that Rutherford Hayes used to describe Garfield and Garfield's just acuity. Hayes said of Garfield, "No, the truth is, no man ever started so low who accomplished so much in the history of our republic. Not Abraham Lincoln or Benjamin Franklin, even." And when you're comparing an American's mind, an American president's mind, to Lincoln and Franklin, and you're saying that you've exceeded them in what you're able to accomplish based on where you started, that's a pretty remarkable soul there.
Yeah.
And I think he might have been the greatest intellect to ever occupy the White House, James Garfield. You know, I mentioned that he'd authored a proof of the Pythagorean theorem, that he was this accomplished lawyer, that he was this policy savant in Congress. He was also multilingual. He could speak decent German, good French, and even a little bit of Yiddish that he studied in his free time. He had this party trick that he did, and you know, just as a bit of a non sequitur here, he was able to write Greek and Latin, one in each hand, simultaneously on different pages, and so he would do that as kind of a bit of a performance trick, and then. This really drew me in when I was in my early research phase here in here in Washington, because I went through his diaries, and in his diary for the year of 1878, and you've read the book, so you know this, he opened the majority of his daily entries with a Shakespearean verse.
Yeah, yeah.
And when somebody, one, that led to the easiest editorial decision of my life, which is as soon as I saw that he did that, I was like, fantastic. I have a president who's opening his diary with Shakespeare. I am going to use these for my chapter titles. So that was how that was he did me a solid on that. But two, you get a sense of somebody who is not just a phenomenal intellect, but who is very aware that they are dealing with these themes that Shakespeare wrote about, which is power and statecraft and ambition and love and all of these compelling things. And when you have an American politician who's both aware that of the field in which they're operating and the importance of their work, and then who has a big enough brain screwed onto him, and his brain was literally very big.
Right.
Go back to that later.
That
makes it very fun to write about. In short, I think he would be an excellent guest on your show if he was still around today.
I would have loved to have him for an interview, because he just had such a multifaceted individual. And before we take a quick pause, I did want to say, at first I thought it was odd. I said, geez, this guy keeps quoting Shakespeare. But then I thought about it, and by the time I got to the end of the book, I said to myself, this was his motivation. He found somebody who inspired him. That inspiration was probably what got him from the first time, from the first moments in the morning when he woke up, to got him through the day. And I think if we all had some form, I'm not saying it has to be Shakespeare, but some form of motivation, something you can look forward to, some inspiration that carries you through the day and helps you to achieve all those goals. And he certainly did that. I did want to take a quick pause to remind listeners that you're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. I'm Al Voner, and this is this week's edition of The Public Eye. My guest is biographer and author C.W. Goodyear. His new book is President Garfield, and we're talking about the 20th President of the United States, a name that does not resonate with everybody. Of course, C.W. and myself happen to be history lovers, so this is certainly up our alley, but as C.W. has been talking about, this is a man that came from extremely humble beginnings. In fact, even by today's standards, most people would say, boy, does he or she have a road ahead of them. And C.W., I think, you know, by today's standards, and I know things were different back, you know, back then, but the fact of the matter is, I mean, you know, he did not have somebody didn't come along one day in a shiny limousine and say, hey, you look like a superstar, you know, jump on board. He had to make it, and that's why I used the word bootstrapper. Everything he did, and you talked about many of his accomplishments, but it was just, it was that raw desire, right? I mean, nobody gave him anything.
No, no one did. Well, he very much knew that. And when you read about somebody, and this is, I think, still true today, when you encounter somebody who started very low in a very humble station in life, particularly in America, and then who end up at the very end, they're still not quite over it. As in, there is a little bit of, not necessarily trauma, but there's a little bit of a chip on the shoulder with how much they came through. Garfield did make all of his own opportunities in life. You know, I mentioned all of those accomplishments that he made, all of those barriers he'd broken in pretty much every aspect of public service available in America, from the military to law to Congress. You know, he had been this young prodigy, this, and especially at the beginning of his life, this firebrand of American politics. But he had done that all himself, and he had done that with a love of knowledge, as we discussed earlier. He had a true addiction to it, and then also his ambition. He hated the idea of not exceeding his circumstances. He wanted to be one of those Americans who have their environment be defined by them rather than be defined by their environment. Whether he did so or not, I think, is a little bit complicated. But in later life, this is a quote that he gave when he was a brigadier general, and he had just become the youngest brigadier general in Washington. In the Union Army. He was on the verge of becoming the youngest congressman in the country at the same time. And he was on a tour in D.C. He was in the little lull in his Civil War fighting. And he's engaging in D.C. as a lot of people in D.C. do these days. You always run into these super young, hyper-ambitious, very privileged kids. And Garfield met the same group of people back in his day. This was about halfway through the Civil War. And he became incredibly agitated by running into these more privileged people at about his age who had had more opportunities than him. And he had worked his way up to their station and maybe a little bit higher, since he was this kind of becoming this public celebrity by that point. But he writes home to his wife of the great resentment he feels encountering these privileged Americans. And he keeps on reflecting on his early life. And he writes, "Let no man praise me for having been born poor and without a helper. It was in every way bad for my life." Because he's running into these people in Washington who are cabinet officials and who are already congressmen, and they're saying, good for you. How impressive. You worked your way up from, you told us that you were from rural Ohio, that you never knew your dad, that you were a canalman for a time, and that you were a janitor in your first school. And, you know, fantastic that you made it here. And that would only get part of him a little bit agitated.
Yeah.
And there's another thing that he wrote, which was, I'm going to paraphrase, but he wrote, "What more could I have accomplished in life if I had been born to having a father and some wealth?" And so he accomplished so much. He was, again, even before he was elected president, people were finally realizing his impressiveness, and they wrote of him as being the most accomplished American of all time. But him, in his mind, and the way his mind worked and how competitive he was, he would always wonder, what more could I have done if I had been given more to start out with? And that's very compelling to me. But I also want to mention he had a bit of a blind spot. Well, not quite a blind spot, because he acted on it. But his mom, he was incredibly lucky to be born to Eliza Garfield.
Yeah.
Eliza was
his rock.
He was her youngest son. He reminded her of her husband who had passed away, because he looked just like his dad. And then also, James Garfield, the president, was actually not the first James Garfield in the Garfield family. He was named after the previous favorite son of the family, another James Garfield who had died before he was born. So the mom, Eliza, just doted on the second James, the young James. And he promised after once he was going out into the real world, he promised that he would do everything he could to make the decline of her life, this is his words, peaceful and happy for her.
Yeah.
And so he devoted the rest of his life to he would always have a room in his home for his mom.
Right.
And that included at the White House. He brought her from the he went very famously from a log cabin to a White House. But I think even more poetically, he brought his mom from a log cabin to the White House with him.
I was just going to say, I couldn't think, I'm so glad you brought that up, because it's
as important to the book as any of the accomplishments, because he didn't forget. She was his rock. She was the person that was there for him growing up. He never forgot that. And as he became more successful, he made sure that he could make her as comfortable as possible. And you know, you alluded to the fact he was married and he had children as well. So he was a father. He was a husband, as a family man. So once again, we throw so many things into the mix. But CW, as I said, you and I talked a little bit before the outset of the show, before the beginning of the show, and I said, geez, I wish we had 2 hours, because you could just go on and on about talking about this guy. But I just want to move to another segment that still sticks with me. I knew before reading your book that Garfield had been, again, one of those presidents that was assassinated. But in reading the book, you find so many people from both sides of the aisle. And I'm talking about politicians, everyday people. You know, everybody seemed to respect him. What were the reasons for his assassination? Was this, again, like a Lincoln situation, that, you know, here's another guy that feels that everybody should have equality, everybody should be treated the same, and you know, somebody just wanted to take him out?
Yeah, well, I'd say it was, so it's by the end of his life, and the reason that Garfield got elected to the presidency anyway was because he was the last what I'd call pathologically reasonable person left in an increasingly irrational Washington. This was 1880. This was the beginning of the Gilded Age, and the partisanship and the fracturing of American society along ideological lines, economic lines, racial lines, had created this political system of that time where people were defined by their politics first and their place in society first, rather than their personality. Garfield was the exception to that rule. He was, because of his nature and then also because of his political inclinations, he was seen as personally, on a personal level, the most popular man still in Washington. He was a moderate, and he believed very much in listening to the other side of an argument, and not only listening, but also being friendly personally with his political opponents. And he that was distinctive of him at this time, and he had these great writings on that. He wrote once, "To be an extreme man is doubtless comfortable. It is painful to see so many sides to a subject." And he was saying that in response to criticism from other Republicans like Ulysses Grant, like Frederick Douglass, that he was, by being this open-minded, friendly figure in Washington, that he was actually being very weak.
Yeah.
Garfield would rebut it and say, no, being open-minded and being a compromiser is actually a symbol of great strength.
Right.
It takes discipline. It takes being willing to be, to buck, you know, the party line, or to just give way to rationality rather than political instinct, you know, thinking through the logic of a given position. And so when it came time for the Republican Party to pick its nominee for the 1880 convention, for the 1880 presidential United States convention, the party became so deadlocked behind the declared candidates from all these different factions that not quite at the last minute, because a lot of planning went into this, but Garfield, who was just a delegate at the convention, he was a floor manager for another candidate, people picked him off the floor and they said, you know, you're the only one who could possibly unite our party in this moment. Mm. And he resisted. He was very scared of the presidency. But he ended up being essentially half forced to accept the presidential nomination. And he led his campaign and he led his administration in the way that he had tried to lead his political life beforehand. He was this person who was just irrationally devoted to being a rational person, to acknowledging the views and trying to accommodate the interests of everybody at the table of the Republican Party. He failed in doing that as president. He ended up having a very big spat with one faction of his party. He ended up winning that fight with them. But in the toxic rhetoric and in the excitement that had been generated nationwide by this big falling out between the president and this faction of his party, a mentally ill man got the wrong impression and ended up shooting Garfield in the back in a train station here in Washington, D.C. And he died very slowly. He died of the infection, not the wound. But you compare him to Lincoln, and there's actually a lot of common ground there first, because actually Americans of that time, many thought Garfield's assassination was actually even more destructive to the country than Lincoln's.
Wow.
And the reason they thought that was because, first, Garfield's shooting happened in peacetime.
Right.
And it was the second assassination. And so when Lincoln had been shot, the national trauma was strong for good reason, but people wrote it off as being a product of war. And in a nation at war, and this wartime fever that had infiltrated the country, Garfield was shot only, you know, a decade and a half later. And he was shot when it seemed there was no reason for a president to be killed
right.
in that manner. Americans
yeah.
became surprised. They're like, oh, man, is this something that we're now going to have to worry about being normalized, presidents being under assassination threats
yeah.
from the public? And the writing of the time, you have these editors that are saying, well, now we're going to have to keep every single president behind a line of guards. They're not going to be able to interact with the public anymore because they're going to be afraid of every handshake having a pistol in it.
You know, that's so reminiscent of, you know, the times that we live in. We've seen that
yes,
with the Kennedys
exactly.
and, you know, and that's another thing that, you know, a deja vu, if you will. And I just thought, Jesus, they thought like we did. They really weren't all that different back then. They had the same
no.
fears and everything else. I wish we had more time because you know the book is magnificent, first of all. And I always say to the listening audience that you know this is not something you don't have to go back and take a test. This is not something that's going to have all kinds of hardcore stats. CW has done a great job of bringing a human being to the forefront in describing the life and times of President James Garfield. CW, real quick, people obviously the book is widely available, and I would urge people to go out and buy it. But if they want to pose any questions, get more information about you directly, is there a website or a Twitter or some way of reaching out to you directly?
Sure. I have a website called CW Goodyear Books. That was fairly easy to set up. And then I also, I'm on Instagram at CW Goodyear.
Yeah.
And let's see, my publisher is Simon & Schuster. The book is up for pre-order. So I think that'll be enough. If anybody has any questions, they'll have a lot of means to ask them.
Yeah.
But thanks, Al.
No, it was a fantastic book. It really is. I really enjoyed reading it because it brought to light a U.S. president that does not get much attention and yet had so much talent and so much to give. And like Lincoln and like many others, his life was taken way too early. But a magnificent take on American history and the rich fabric of this country. If you have any questions about the broadcast, you can certainly give us a call here at the studios at WICN. Our main number is 508-752-0700. You can pose any comments or questions and feedback to me directly. I always welcome that. That's Al Vona, V-U-O-N-A, at WICN.org. For the public eye, this is Al Vona. Thank you so much for tuning in.